Yeah, let's do it. I'm pumped. Let's let the healing begin.
God help you if you use voiceover in your work, my friends. God help you. It's flaccid, sloppy writing.
I don't want you to be the guy in the PG-13 movie everyone's really hoping makes it happen. I want you to be like the guy in the rated R movie, you know? The guy you're not sure whether or not you like yet.
Hello and welcome to the 101st episode of the Get Your Film Fix podcast. Today we're going to be discussing, in honor of its 25th anniversary, Jurassic Park. Then we're going to move on to a kind of a brief discussion of the evolution of visual effects in the film industry. Then we're going to wrap it up with our top five cinematic worlds we'd love to live in.
There it is.
Welcome to Jurassic Park.
We've made living biological attractions so astounding that they'll capture the imagination of the entire planet.
The most phenomenal discovery of our time.
How'd you do this?
Becomes the greatest adventure of all time.
Can I touch it?
Sure.
Universal Pictures presents.
You feel that?
Hold on to your butts.
A Steven Spielberg film.
Fences are failing all over the park.
Yeah, that's nice. Gotta go.
An adventure.
Look out! No!
I can't get Jurassic Park back online.
65 million years in the making. Jurassic Park.
Gentlemen, Steven Spielberg was kind of maligned in 1975 when Jaws came out because they've sort of sacked him with the responsibility of inventing the modern summer blockbuster. And usually that's a good thing. He, you know, presumably made a lot of money from Jaws and has certainly made a lot of money from all his other movies, but he's got the unfortunate title of having created the summer blockbuster. And now, you know, I think that's probably true. You know, we can talk about that if you guys want later on. But to me, I've always used Jurassic Park as kind of a waypoint in the evolution of the modern blockbuster. To me, that was a real kickoff. And I think in a lot of ways, it's the modern template for the summer blockbuster. And I mean that in kind of a bad way. I mean that for better or worse, really. And to me, I think what I was, when I was preparing for this podcast and I was thinking about it, you know, it was sort of the harbinger of the visual effects age. That's pretty obvious, but I think they like tapped into a formula, and I think we can talk about what that formula is in more specificity. But I think the real thing that they tackled here was, and John Hammond says it in the movie, that the main audience for this is kids. Okay. To me, that is what Steven Spielberg's discovered with Jurassic Park. And we all saw this when we were, you know, 8 or 9. I presume we all saw this in theaters. And I think the resurgence and the popularity of, say, Jurassic World has a lot to do with nostalgia, for example. So I guess my question for you guys is, one, do you agree with what I'm saying? And two, you know, having rewatched it, you know, now with your modern knowledge of movies and with your maybe your critic's hat on pretty tightly, how did it hold up?
I definitely agree with you, and I actually kind of wonder, did Spielberg consciously do that? Did he consciously make this movie to try to bring in a younger audience, or was it sort of an accidental happy discovery? And I don't know the answer to that, because it is a very like crowd-pleasing movie for all generations, really. And I'm not sure if Spielberg was like, all right, great, let's pull in that market of younger kids and have them watch a movie that also their parents would enjoy, or if he was just like, this is a great idea, I'm going to make this movie. And then, as you said, Chapin, we sort of take the summer blockbuster from there because of that. I don't know the answer to that. I'd be curious to ask him next time he's on the podcast.
Yeah. there's certainly no denying the draw that this movie has, especially for kids. And I think Spielberg, I think that has to do with, you know, whether, you know, it's intentional or just the director that he is I think he's the best ever at when it comes to a creative vision and integrating that into a compelling story. And I think that creativity aspect is what does it. And whether that be Jurassic Park or Close Encounters or, you know, Indiana Jones, I guess he did he direct any of the Indiana Jones?
Yeah, all of them.
Oh, really?
Yep, all four.
I can always get so confused with him and Lucas and that whole group about who's directing those movies. He directed all the Star Wars too, right?
No.
But yeah, I guess, you know, I think, you know, Spielberg is so good at that, and that creativity is what draws that younger audience. And then when it comes to the blockbuster and the modern blockbuster and the formula, I mean, I totally agree that there is a formula that's followed, and it's something that we're actually really hard on here. And I guess looking at Jurassic Park, even looking back at Jurassic Park, it's hard for me to critique that, regardless of how tight the critic's hat is on, because it may have been the first one to do it. It's the same way it's hard to critique, early film noirs for doing something that's we've seen done, you know, over and over and over again, and maybe feel it's gotten stale. You know, anytime you are the, the first one to do something, I think you get a free pass.
Sure. Yeah. Well, you know, I think it's a testament to what you were just describing, Lee, the Spielberg skills. I've been kind of caught up in Jurassic fever since we started watching that movie, or since I reviewed the movie like last weekend in preparation for the podcast, and I started reading the book. I've read the book a bunch of times, but I've started reading the book again, and I watched The Lost World, like the sequel to this, and man, it's really surprising to look at it and kind of look at everything, you know, with the perspective of having it fresh in my mind, everything Spielberg did right in Jurassic Park, and then 4 short years later, it's kind of doing everything wrong. I mean, that movie is actually pretty bad.
You think so?
I think it's pretty bad. I think
I don't want to get into it. I don't mind it. I mean, I think actually relatively recently saw it and expected it to be terrible, but I really thought it wasn't. Well, I mean, it's ridiculous, especially the end, but I didn't mind it. But anyway, another discussion for another day.
Yeah, I mean, I just think so. But I don't know. Maybe we could talk about some of the things I thought he did really well. I mean, I think what was sort of fascinating to me to look at it from the perspective of what I was describing in my intro was just how that what he's done has been co-opted and not really replicated in a way. Like I think, like we've got this comic book era, which this comic book craze, you know, all these comic book movies, superhero movies, and you can see where Jurassic Park is in there. The formula is in there, but I don't think anybody's really been able to do it as well as Spielberg has. And I haven't seen Ready Player One, and I don't know that Spielberg has, you know, topped himself in this genre before. I mean, obviously he's made some really great movies since then that we probably love a lot more than Jurassic Park, but he's sort of tapped into that sort of perfect kind of modern blockbuster. I mean, you know, I don't know. Do you guys have any thoughts on that?
The interesting thing for me about, you know, especially with Jurassic Park in comparison to, you know, quote unquote summer blockbusters now is, you know, this movie, oddly, nostalgia is not the right word for me. I actually can't be sure that I saw the original one in the theater. I think I may have seen it a little bit after its release on video at some point.
Yeah, I think our parents didn't let us, Lee.
Yeah, so, I mean, but regardless, Jeremy, as I was writing this down, of course, this came to mind. We worked with a director once upon a time that loved talking about movie magic.
Yeah.
You may remember that. And for me, Jurassic Park is the definition of, like, the magic of movies. And I think that's what gets me about it. And, like, that's what sticks with me. And, like, that's something that I don't get now with really many movies at all, but especially not the summer blockbuster. And, you know, whether or not it's formulaic, I think, is secondary to that. And, like, that's why I think, honestly, I'm curious, very curious to hear what you guys have to say about this movie, because it's been really hard for me to kind of responsibly critique it, because I'm just swept up by the magic of this movie. And I think, like, that's what Spielberg has a skill to do. And maybe, you know, there's very, very few directors that can do it the way that he can do it. And this is the movie of his that has done it the most over the years for me.
Yeah, it's an interesting point you bring up, Javen, because I wonder if there are kids out there that maybe watch the newest Avengers movie and they're like, at this point, I don't know, early 20s, late teens, and have sort of a nostalgia for the first Iron Man movie. I don't think that that exists like it does for this Jurassic Park movie. Although I'm getting the sense from you guys, and I thought, and I could be wrong, but I thought I'd be alone on this because I don't have a nostalgia for this first Jurassic Park movie. When I felt the same way watching it this time around that I kind of felt the first time around. It doesn't hold a place in my heart like Indiana Jones does, like Jaws does. It doesn't resonate with my sort of watching it through my child's eyes as much as those do. So I thought for sure you guys were gonna say, well, it's hard to critique this movie, or it's hard to judge this movie, or it's hard to put your critic's hat on this movie because it was such a childhood, it was so important to your childhood.
Well, that's true for me. It's not necessarily
you don't have that, but you said you didn't have the nostalgic feel.
Yeah, it's a weird thing, and I think it's because I don't remember loving this movie as a kid. I almost remember loving this movie as like an appreciation for, like I said, the magic of movies. And, you know, the score, and like I sort of just get like totally swept up in it as more as an adult than I think I did as a kid. And maybe I'm just not remembering, but I totally don't, like what you said, I don't feel like I can put my critic's hat on as well as I'd like to for this movie, but it's nostalgia's not exactly the right word.
Maybe you're nostalgic for a nostalgic time you never had with it in a weird way. I don't know if that makes sense or not, but like you want to see it. You're seeing it as, like you're saying, Lee, like as a magical movie or movie experience. And that's kind of like, you want to see it how you would have seen it back if you saw it originally in the theaters or something.
That's definitely the part about seeing it in the theater. Like I can't even imagine like the awe that I would have had seeing this in the theater as a kid. And I wasn't like a big dinosaur guy either. Like I think the reason maybe the nostalgia piece isn't a big element is because I didn't have an eye for movies when I was that young. And when I first saw it,
Jurassic Park. Well, you're not supposed to.
No, you're not. But the thing that I'm so impressed
by. Lee's watching 400 Blows as
it's one of my favorites. Well, I loved Truffaut as a young kid.
I used to love him as a 7-year-old.
As a young 9-year-old, you're getting into the French New Wave.
Oh, me and Jeremy used to get in these so many arguments about Godard and Truffaut. Yeah. Ugh.
The old
Godard Truffaut debate. I think it's more that like I'm so in awe of the movie, almost from a film critic's perspective, to the point where I can't critique it professionally.
Well, you should get off the podcast then.
All right.
Chapin, what did you think?
I did see this in theaters, and it's one of those I was telling you guys about. I think a couple podcasts ago that I have these rare. I don't usually remember where I see movies, you know, but like occasionally I have these very distinct times seeing it where I remember exactly who I was with and exactly where I saw it. And I have one of those experiences with Jurassic Park. I remember I was 8. And I saw it in the theaters. I was so super excited. And I went to the bathroom 7 times because I was so afraid of the raptors. I went with my dad, and I can tell you exactly what movie theater I went to. It's pretty crazy. I mean, I was obsessed with this movie when I saw it. I bought one of those Dilophosaurus masks that I would wear around like a weirdo. And I mean, yeah, and I think
which dinosaur was that?
That's the one that spits. I wanted the raptor, but my parents got me the Dilophosaurus.
The raptor's too violent.
And it's interesting because I think that I got caught up on that in that nostalgia a little bit, going back to what the two of you guys were discussing, and I have found it one of the great tragedies of my adult life that I'm not really able to watch movies like a real person anymore. You know, I look too specifically at the cinematography, or you know, noticing the editing, or you know, too kind of hyper focused, too acutely focused on things. And you know, even when I try to take a step back in these, you know, when I'm watching them for Get Your Film Fix, and you know, hoping to get a better experience, it's hard even to do that because, you know, I still make stuff to some extent. I make commercials, and I'm really invested in all this stuff, and I'm like in the weeds in all of it, and so it's hard to step back and like look at it as a whole, which ultimately is another irony, because as a filmmaker, as a content maker, you need to be able to look at stuff as a whole, as opposed to an individual basis. But long story short, I watched this movie and I was like reminding myself to like look for things. I got so caught up in the nostalgia. I was like, you know, I want to look for the Spielberg Wonder. That's a very famous, like Spielberg's, you know, single takes, and like looking for traits that I knew. And I like, you know, and I didn't see a lot of that, which was great, because I got caught up in the, I don't know if I got caught up in the movie like I did when I was 8 years old, but I think I got caught up in maybe the, like we were talking about, the nostalgia of it.
I was the same way in looking at it. Like I kept trying, like I literally was writing down everything I could. And like, I have notes that are like the most petty things that to critique that like aren't even worth mentioning. But you know, my question is like, isn't that like, so why dig deeper than that? Like, doesn't that mean it's a good movie? If that every time you're looking for something, you know, to critique, you are brought back into the movie and you can't find it.
I think so. I mean, yeah, absolutely. I think it's interesting to look at. Spielberg made this movie. He shot this movie like in the summer, and then was shooting.
Flew off to Poland
to do Schindler's List, and as Michael Kahn, I listened to an interview with Michael Kahn. He's Spielberg's editor. He's got this great Brooklyn accent. He's like, yeah, they set up a saucer for us in Poland, and so they were like sending them the visual effects shots. And so he didn't really even finish the movie. Spielberg didn't even really finish the movie, and so he had these two great, I mean, amazing movies made in 1993, that are just great for completely different reasons. And even Spielberg said, like, you know, Jurassic Park was me using every technique I have, you know, every technique I had in the book I used, and I used it super effectively. But like, Schindler's List was about, you know, feeling and emotion and tapping into my emotional intelligence. And I think you're right, Lee. Like, it's interesting to think about, like, you know, Schindler's List is a brilliant film, as we know, but, you know, which one would you rather watch on a Friday night?
Well, actually, I mean, well, obviously that's true, but which one do you think we could dissect better?
And yeah, it's a good point, Lee, because I feel like even on this conversation, which is really interesting, and we're kind of talking about Spielberg, and we're talking about nostalgia, and we're talking about how our tastes and our viewership has changed over the years, we haven't really gotten into any of how we felt about this movie. Like, do we like it? Do we enjoy it? Was it like something that we just sat there and we couldn't distinguish one for like our old selves from our new selves? Like, for me, I felt that I felt very similar this time around that I did maybe the first time I saw this movie. I was captivated by it. I was taken in by it, but I wasn't overall that impressed with the story itself, because basically the screenplay has a bit of lazy writing. Like, the screenplay is basically you invent dinosaurs, you go to the island, and things go bad for 85% of the movie, and you sit there and you enjoy that. You enjoy, like, because you're on an island with dinosaurs. I mean, it's amazing, but like there's these little personality traits that were tried to weave in there, but they really didn't care that much about, you know,
yeah,
how Dr. Grant like didn't like kids, and then he stuck with kids,
yeah,
or the younger girl, she's like has an off remark about like, I'm a hacker, I'm not into nature, and then she's able to use her hacking skills.
How about the lawyer showing up at the amber mine in the Dominican Republic just for a little bit of exposition there? Was he there? Why he's on like a little raft and they're pulling him. Well, we got a problem with the park, let me go to the amber mine in the Dominican Republic.
Right, exactly. So my point is, like, I think this movie on its surface is really enjoyable to watch, but it's hard for us to get sort of a deep dive into it, because really, if you look at it, like I said, there's this beginning bit where we sort of get a very small backstory of these characters, and then basically you're almost immediately thrown into things getting fucked up, and it's a survival movie from then on out.
Well, you know,
I'm just saying, like, I think that's why we're having a tougher time sort of getting into the nitty gritty of reviewing this movie.
Well, I think there's some things to criticize. I don't want to give myself too much credit as a young child, but I don't remember. I remember thinking the acting wasn't particularly good in this movie, and that was reinforced again. I think, strangely, Spielberg is someone maybe who has evolved to appreciate actors a little bit more since making this movie, but I feel like it's kind of a B or C list of what do you, people did, to be.
You didn't know Daniel Day-Lewis played the T-Rex?
Oh, I did. Yeah, he got so into character.
Fucking brilliant!
It's amazing.
I wonder if you guys go play a little guessing game. Do you guys? There was a revelation for me in terms of who was the best performance in this movie, and it was very surprising to me. Do you guys want to take a guess as to
who? I mean, I can say who mine was. It's definitely Jeff Goldblum. He stole the show every time it was on the screen.
Well, I think there's someone else.
I mean, I think Goldblum is good. I think Wayne Knight is good.
That's who it is. I think Wayne Knight is great. The best performance in the movie, and I'm not even joking.
And actually, though, if I can, before I kind of defend the movie a bit, in response to Jeremy, one critique that I did write down is Newman's, sorry, Nedry's storyline, that is his death is so anticlimactic. Like, his whole arc is anticlimactic.
It's such a big part
of the movie to begin with, and like it adds a second element of stakes, and then they kind of decide, well, this isn't really what the movie is about, so let's do away with him. And that was something that I did write down that was an issue. But to defend this movie a little bit, Jeremy, in response to what you were saying with kind of the character development and, you know, the story, and I hate to be this guy to say, like, you know, it's not the type of movie that needs, you know, super developed characters. But at the same time, like, this, I feel like this movie would be hampered by too many layers to the characters. I think there's enough there so that they're not one-dimensional. You know, the idea that, you know, there's, you have a relationship between Ellie and Dr. Grant, and it seems great, but there's a friction in the kids element. You know, they want to get married. They, you know, she wants to start a family.
Not the kids to them. Okay, I got it.
Yeah, that's and it's not explored real deeply, but it's there and it's enough. And yeah, maybe it's a little bit you know, on the nose to then, you know, have the little kid be like, oh, I'm gonna ride in whatever car you want to ride in, and you know, so you know, that's a little on the nose, but I don't think there was any real necessity to go deep into some of these characters. And I think I kind of like the fact that you learn enough about who they are, and you know, there's certain scenes, there's the scene when they're all having dinner and they're kind of you know, making their or voicing their objections to the park within kind of their area of expertise, and you learn enough about them, and I think that's all you really need in order for this movie to follow the arc that it does.
Yeah, I mean, that's interesting that you bring that up, because I think, you know, the book is really about the themes of the book are, like, you know, the threat of technology and, you know, science and the responsibility that scientists has, and kind of the, even more specifically, the sort of capitalization of science, you know, the profitability aspect in science. And I don't know that this movie has all that. I mean, they talk about those things, especially in that scene that you mentioned, Lee, but like, I don't know that that's really the focus of the movie. I don't know that the film comes down either side. And sorry, Jeremy, what were you gonna say?
Well, it leads into my point, but I agree. Like, I think this movie should have been either completely one way or another, and it definitely like lean towards being just this sort of action survival movie, which is great. But I feel like they added just enough of that stuff that you were just talking about, Chapin, about the bigger themes about technology and you know, man's relationship to nature and all that stuff. And then all these little tweaks of a backstory, enough of it to get me interested enough that I don't know if you guys feel the same way, but I was kind of surprised how quickly things went south in this. I was hoping that before Newman's character there decided to screw up all the park's electricity and gates and all that, that there was more time. And I remember in my head from when I watched it previously that there was more time. But I guess it happens pretty quickly. And then the movie just becomes about survival after that. And yeah. I don't know. It's like pick one side or the other on that scale. You're either going to be like The Revenant, or you're going to be a more of a thought-provoking sci-fi sort of piece. And I feel like, I don't know. It's not bad. I you know, I still really enjoyed it, but it was the little stuff that irked me.
No, I do think there are two movies here, and I think this is great that, like, you know, again, like I said, I had a hard time critiquing this movie, and I think this conversation is actually kind of enlightening in that fact, where you can, you know, it brings some things to light with, you know, there are those elements.
It's enlightening in that it brings things to light.
Right, yeah. That sounded so much more, like, articulate in my head when I said that. No wonder. No, that just, you know, this movie does evolve into... I hate to say it because I don't really believe that it is one, but a monster movie.
There's nothing wrong quintessentially with a monster movie.
Well, no, there's not. But I think in many ways it's not you know, a typical monster movie. You know, I think the new Jurassic Park movies, Jurassic World, those are monster movies where it's the humans versus the dinosaurs and. You know, they got to make sure that they got to kill the dinosaur at the end if they're going to survive, well, or the dinosaur is going to kill them.
I don't think that's true. Like, what annoys me about those new movies is that, like, the raptors are like on the humans' teams.
Well, yeah, look, I can't wait to see Jurassic World: Fallen Kingdom, but they suck. Anyway, I think this movie tries to have an arc in the science element, and It's literally almost with that one line and one shot from John Hammond, Richard Attenborough, who I also think is really good in this.
Yeah, he is really good.
Where he says it's over, but then even more importantly, when they're about to get on the helicopter and he has that look on his face where he's kind of looking back at the park and realizing he failed. And, you know, I think that's sort of bookending that element of, you know, science and, you know, the consequences of science and the consequences of you know, playing God, which I think, you know, is a pretty on the nose metaphor, not necessarily in a bad way, that they have with him. You know, he wears white the whole movie, and, you know, I think that's all there. But I do agree with you, Jeremy, that, you know, very quickly this, you know, this movie is very detailed, and the conversation at dinner is very intentional about the flaws and the risks. And you know, if you even watch that, you know, little video that they have on the ride where they're explaining how they clone dinosaurs, like, there's some, you know, interesting details about the prehistoric frogs or whatever that they use to kind of fill in the strands. And there's a lot of, I think, smart details that I'm assuming came directly from the book. And then it quickly turns into the electricity's gone, here comes the T-Rex, and it's a different movie.
In the first film, we had maybe 20 colors to paint with, and this time we've had 40 colors to paint with. Well, that doesn't mean it's going to be a better painting. Special effects are just a tool, a means of telling a story. People have a tendency to confuse them as an end to themselves. A special effect without a story is a pretty boring thing.
Moving on, I thought it would be an interesting place to jump off to talk kind of about modern visual effects here. And I sent you guys a little article that had a video that talked kind of about, you know, why Jurassic Park's visual effects still hold up. And I think that's, you know, debatable. But I think basically the thing to understand is that they kind of revolutionarily in this movie combined the sort of burgeoning visual effects industry with animatronics, so they would cut between the two. And anytime basically there was a full body shot of one of the dinosaurs, it would be a visual effect. And when there were close-ups, it was an animatronic. And I think an interesting thing to think about to show how much the visual effects has sort of permeated the film industry these days is to compare the number of shots. And so basically that's how many visual effects shots were done for the movie. And in Jurassic Park, there were 60 or 62 or something like that. And in a modern movie like, I don't know, Jurassic World, for example, there were 2,000. And in a movie like Avengers Infinity War, there are like over 3,000, which I think is like got to be like 80 or 90% of the movie at that point. I don't know how many shots are typically in a movie, but and I just on a personal note, the kind of the reason I wanted to talk about this, I've been sort of fascinated in following that movie Solo, the Star Wars movie Solo, and all the reshoots and problems that they've been having. And I just kept hearing about like, yeah, they're going to go and reshoot all this, all, you know, 70% of the movie, and the directors got fired. And I saw the movie, and there's so much of it is visual effects. I started to think to myself, what did they go and reshoot? Like there isn't even, there is so, like, everything is a visual effect these days. And yeah, I think, and Jeremy, I know you've worked on a couple of big visual effects movies, and you might be able to speak to, you know, what those are like to work on. I know you're doing locations on those. So sometimes, you know, a green screen isn't always the most interesting location, but I just think in a lot of ways, you know, we talked about this.
Jeremy found that green screen.
Jeremy hung it up.
We scouted it.
We talked about, you know, last week we talked about the Marvel rise in the last 10 years. And a lot of those movies are leading the charge in this field. And I think in a lot of ways they have anesthetized, if I'm using that term right, the film going experience. I think a lot of it, they're taking a lot of the reality out of it. And because of that, movies can feel very, you kind of feel inoculated to it in a way. They don't, you have a lack of emotion for it. And, anyways, that's just kind of a jumping off point.
Yeah. I mean, I can follow up about the few movies I've worked on that have been sort of VFX heavy. I know you wanted me to talk about this classic cinema, R.I.P.D., that I worked on. But I worked basically at the stage for that one, so it was hard for me to tell on a day-to-day basis because a lot of that was green screen. It was, you know, Ryan Reynolds in some sort of contraption being flipped around with flame bars around him and then just a giant green screen in the background. So it was, as somebody who's just standing there, I don't know what the hell is happening.
Of course.
And then when I watched, the movie, I really didn't know what the hell was happening. But on a smaller scale, which was sort of an easier way for me to understand how a lot of this works, and you're going to laugh about it, but it really was kind of interesting, was on Stronger.
With Gyllenhaal's legs.
With Gyllenhaal's legs, because every scene had to have him, well, every scene post-Marathon Bomb had to have him wearing this sort of, these two green, giant green socks.
Because he played, that movie is about, for people that don't know, is about the guy who survived the Marathon Bombing and got his legs blown off.
Jeff Bowman, yeah. He wrote a book called Stronger, which the movie was also called Stronger, and Jake Gyllenhaal played him. And it was interesting to see, because you could see how the visual effects had to work around an actor's physical performance, and also with the actual locations and background and all that stuff. You could see how everybody had to cater to that a little bit, and how Gyllenhaal himself had to cater to this idea that he didn't have legs when he had the crutches and stuff like that, and how he had to move and how he had to lift his leg up, you know, if he's in the wheelchair, stuff like that. And I know it's like a small thing, but it was tangible, you know what I mean?
Sure.
Yeah, and I think that's a good example, because that's, you know, I think that speaks to that video, Chapin, that you sent us, the guy that did it, or somebody in the video was saying that with Jurassic Park, the goal wasn't spectacle, it was to recreate reality, which I think is very accurate. And I think and this is maybe where I disagree with you for what you said originally, is I think that's what makes Jurassic Park some of the best use of CGI ever. And yeah, the animation has gotten better. The computer graphics have gotten better as far as their
I would almost disagree with that.
Authenticity, but like I think that the use is never been done better than in a movie like Jurassic Park, and I think it's because it was done to recreate reality, which essentially on a very small scale is what they did in Stronger. There was no interest in creating a spectacle by taking by removing legs from Jake Gyllenhaal. It was to recreate the reality of this character, and I think that's the difference. That's the key that needs to be done. And with a movie like Avatar, and with movies like Rampage, and you know, to a certain, and I mean, to a large extent, the Marvel movies, I think, and definitely the new Jurassic Park movies, and then again, Roland Emmerich movies. It's for spectacle. People are going because they want to see New York City destroyed, or the bigger dinosaur, or whatever it may be.
Yeah, and I guess my point was Stronger was that, like, the whole filmmaking process, it doesn't necessarily really have to change or has to become computerized or all that. It's just, it's how you interact with the environment using the technology. And if the actors can interact with the environment, and the designers and the art directors and the cinematographers can still interact with the environment in a very tangible way, but are able to use the technology and not get lost in it, which I think a lot of these bigger movies that we just, like you just rattled off, Lee, they get lost in it, and it's not about interacting with the environment, whether it's CGI or it's real. It's more about making those CGI images seem real, but then you forget to have every other aspect of the filmmaking process, which is a very layered process, interact with the CGI or the green screen or whatever it is. So I think filmmakers sometimes get lost in it, and that's why a lot of times we get blasé or sick of these movies, because it's, we just see it over and over again, and we feel the separation between the CGI and the artistic creative parts of filmmaking.
Chapin, you brought up a point on a podcast a long time ago that about with scenes with CGI, the camera ends up in places where it can't be, and that's what takes you out of the movie. Like all of a sudden the camera is, you know, 25 feet in the air, you know, face to face with a monster or something, which doesn't fit into the reality of the movie, you know. And they brought this up, I can't remember if I was watching some special features on Jurassic Park, I don't remember if I saw it there or in this video you sent, about them talking about how the dinosaurs in Jurassic Park are from the character's perspective, and that makes a difference.
Yeah, I think that's a very that's an important sort of milestone, is this idea of like a digital camera, not a digital camera in the sense that it records digitally. Right, right. It's one that can, you know, that is created in a 3D space in a computer, and that can move around elements that, you know, basically a scene is created in a 3D environment, and the camera can fly around it as it pleases. And so you lose that sense of perspective. You lose that sense of, I think, weight and physics when that camera can basically be anywhere. And there is, you lose that idea of that it being like, okay, what are we creating? We're creating dinosaurs. We're creating superheroes. They're doing these fantastic things, but we're flying along with them, or we're spinning around. And that part of it, I think, is just pure spectacle. I think you're doing that just to show off what you can do. Look how we can.
Yeah, now we're another superhero or another dinosaur. We're not, you know, human beings looking up at this and seeing something that we can't
exactly,
do.
Exactly.
It is interesting with the original Jurassic Park, that the very first moment you see a dinosaur in it, that sort of that shock and awe moment, which is the reveal of it, is great, and it's like classics. Spielberg, the way he reveals the looks on their faces, and the way he turns her head to, like, you know, hey, you need to look at this. But then you see the dinosaur itself, and then that CGI, that moment of CGI, doesn't hold up
enough to
all the other CGI within the same movie. I find that a little bizarre, and I don't know the answer to why that
is. I think I know why.
But
I think
it's like really dated there.
Yeah, it is. I mean, in that particular case, obviously you couldn't make something at all, any element of that dinosaur real, because it was a brachiosaurus or whatever, is huge. But also, I think Spielberg made the right choice in that, like, they decided, I think, kind of at the last minute to film, like, for example, the Tyrannosaurus attack all in the rain. And so a lot of that stuff is obscured. So, like, you know, and at nighttime. And so there's a lot of this, like, everything is obscured and you can't quite, like, you know, the CG doesn't have to hold up quite as well. And it was a smart choice. And it made it very, I think, suspenseful.
It also made it really difficult. Not that Spielberg is any stranger to animatronics not working, but the rain was like making the
dinosaurs, the
animatronic T-Rex, like freak out.
I mean, sorry, go ahead, Lee.
No, go ahead.
Well, I think it's something I wrestle with a little bit, because I would love to see movies kind of make a comeback into, like, you know, like I think CG is probably a great tool. I'd love to see this trend go away. I don't think it's going to, but I mean, I think we need to acknowledge that, you know, we talked so much last week about, we all love The Revenant, was all on our top five list, and there's probably more CG in that movie than we realize.
But the bear attack in that movie is
brilliant,
unreal.
It's amazing. Yeah. And so
you would never know.
But it goes back to my point where it's like the bear attack is serving the story, and nobody behind that camera or Leo or, you know, anyone involved in that film is forgetting what their main objective is there.
Exactly.
In that movie, what actually might even be better is the horse running off the cliff.
Yeah, that was pretty good.
No, that was real. That was really.
Leo went with it.
But, like, I do wonder, you know, that I struggle with it a little bit, because I do think, like, it does give filmmakers tools to do things that they could never do, that bear attack being one of them. But also, you know, for example, you know, Avatar. I mean, you know, say what you will about that movie, but
it's pretty incredible.
It's incredible, and you would never, and like the Jungle Book and movies that are that exist almost entirely in a digital space, that, you know, they are unique and original visions that require this technology to exist, and they could not exist without it.
Right. I mean, look at Pixar. Pixar is a perfect example. They wouldn't exist without a lot of this technology and all that stuff. Because everybody is sort of on the same plane and level, you're totally taken in by it. And it's about storytelling first, but they're in a weird way limited to how everything has to look.
I think Avatar is an interesting movie because it sort of does both. Right? It's the spectacle, but it's also recreating obviously an alternate reality, but a reality with this CG. But I think, you know, I think what frustrates us is that it's used as a crutch. But there is a place for this technology in movies. And I said this about Pacific Rim a couple podcasts ago. Like, there should be movies where this type of technology is on display, because where else are you going to use it, right? And what, you know, and it is a spectacle, and it is cool to see, and how, you know, how things are created that don't exist, and, you know, so I think it's important that movies are still made like this. I think what frustrates me and us is, you know, how haphazardly it's done.
We just wanted to take a minute to plug ourselves, not in a sexual way.
That's always our favorite part of the show.
And just tell everybody that, you know, it's really helpful for us for everybody to like and rate us. And I'm not even sure how much that matters. But you know what I was thinking about? I was thinking about the best thing you could do would just be to recommend the Get Your Film Fix podcast to a friend, somebody who likes podcasts, you know. But also we're up on our socials now. So we're at Get Your Film Fix Podcast on Instagram and Facebook. You can email us at you can email us at feedback@getyourfilmfixpodcast.com. And then what else? Is there anything else, Lee?
Yeah, I mean, look, it's a, you know, we're going to probably continue to do this regardless, but it's like, it's really good for our egos. You know,
yeah, just
even
heart it on Instagram, the little heart button that means you like it, that you love it.
Yeah,
heart is love.
All right, so it's time for our top five list, everybody's favorite segment. So this week we decided to do basically what the theme is movies we'd love to live in. Not that we would necessarily love to live in Jurassic Park. I feel like it would be a short life, but the allure of Jurassic Park.
We would
survive. I mean, we'd obviously
survive. The
three of us?
Come on.
But the allure, obviously, for Jurassic Park is seeing dinosaurs. That's why they did it. And, you know, so...
In real life.
No, but, like, if you had the chance to go there, knowing all you know about how it always ends, I feel like there's a good chance half the population would be like, yep, worth it. I want to see those dinosaurs.
I agree.
So that being said... were there any criteria for you guys? Is it just, did you go pretty broad with it? Like,
I felt this was a pretty broad thing. So I wanted to make it more challenging for myself. And so what I did was I picked worlds or environments that are not sort of, ostensibly appealing. Does that make sense? In other words, like, that aren't like you wouldn't think of as being great, but that they are, but if you had to, I think they'd be nice. Does that make sense?
But is it personal for you?
Very,
Jacob,
very personal.
Okay. Okay. Yeah.
In other words, like,
that's fine. I mean,
yeah.
I mean, for me, the fact that we said live in, I sort of had to see myself obviously being there for a long duration of time and still enjoying it. So it couldn't be like a Jurassic Park where I'd want to be there. I'd want to see it, or whatever movie would get me to the moon or space or something. I wanted to see myself there for, you know, the next 40, 50 years.
Oh, wow. Okay. I didn't do that.
I had sort of a lot of criteria at first. I was saying no fantasy films. I said no true stories. And then I was even saying that there had to be, like, within the movie, there had to be like a role that I could play. And then I scrapped And I scrapped all of those and I ended up with no criteria.
So why'd you mention it?
Yeah, what a waste.
Cause, well, I was trying to like narrow it down, but then I was having too hard a time like finding five movies that fit all my criteria. So I just went with the five that I thought were kind of the most interesting. I'll kick things off. My number five is actually a series of movies. It's sort of impossible to pick just one. And I'd be happy to be, you know, kind of anywhere within this organization, but it's the Bond movies. I'd love to be James Bond. I don't think... I'm not British, so that's the lone reason I wouldn't be able to
be... Yeah, that would be the reason, yeah.
But, you know, I don't know. I could be Q. I like a lot of those...
You're not smart.
Yeah, look, I'm just saying I'd like to be smart. I just think it'd be cool to kind of be, you know, in that organization. And actually, like, honestly, as cool as Bond is with, you know, the killing License to Kill and all the women and all every and like the drinking and cars and all that is great, but like it's exhausting. Like, I don't know, I think some of the guys back at the office might have it a little easier, still get to play with some of the toys. So
you could be M.
I could be M. Come on.
Yeah, I could see you being M.
Yeah.
All right, Chapin, what do you got? Number five.
Okay, so I wanted to make sure I had a war movie on here, but yeah, like I couldn't think about what war I'd want to be in. I don't think war is a pretty awful experience. So I picked the war with the aliens in Edge of Tomorrow, sometimes known as Live, Die, Repeat, with Tom Cruise.
Emily, that's a great pick.
Emily Blunt. Yeah, that's awesome.
I think it'd be fun. Like you know, there really aren't any.
Because even if you die,
you don't really die.
You don't really die, and then you can, like, you know, you can learn to be better, and it's kind of like playing a video game.
Yeah, that's a really good pick.
Excellent.
I had said I had an honorable mention for me, or a couple of honorable mentions for me, were like Braveheart and Gladiator, because like I think immediately when you're put back into that time period as a man, like you're tough and like a good fighter. There's no like wussy men in Braveheart except for the the king's dead gay immediately. Son, but...
Lee would be dead immediately.
I'm just one of the extras. I'm one of the extras.
Here's the problem. You've seen too many movies of those battles. So even if you started and you actually had the courage to go and you killed somebody, and you're, that would be when you take that moment that they always take in the battles and where stop, you look yeah. around and you stop and you, and somebody would immediately cut your head off.
I'd be like singing the Braveheart yeah. music in my head.
All right, my number five is So my number five is Who Framed Roger Rabbit?
Oh, you motherfucker!
Yeah, so it's a world I know there are some consequences, but mostly for toons. Humans are usually fine, and it could get interesting. And have you guys seen Jessica Rabbit?
No, seriously.
I am just saying.
Okay, that's gonna be now my number four.
That's your number four?
It is now, yeah. Who Framed Roger Rabbit?
Well, isn't it your turn?
Yeah.
Yeah, and he's saying it's number four.
Now it's my number four.
Okay. Well, my number four, is it my turn? Yes, of course. Mm-hmm. My number four, I think, and I forgive me for bringing this up again. I think this came up on my another list that was famous bars, but if I had to be stuck someplace without papers, I'd love to be in Casablanca.
Yeah, you keep coming back there on top five.
I think that'd be a great place to be. There's gambling, there's drinking,
mm-hmm. but you just want to be in Rick's cafe.
Yeah, well,
nowhere else.
Well, yeah, that's what I mean. So I like to be.
I guess there's not really anywhere else.
That's the movie. Yeah. The movie's called Casablanca. There also happens to be a place. Yeah. But so, yeah, he's talking about the movie.
Yeah, I'm not actually talking about Casablanca.
This is a film podcast.
gambling, drinking, very interesting company. And I assume because I was American, I'd be able to get out of there pretty easily, anyways. So you know.
Yeah, you'd get those papers, some letters no of problem. Transit.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, it's a great pick and may come.
I just have my mom fax me the, you know, my passport, right? That's how you do that.
Yeah. You call your mom.
All right. So my number four is, you know, we always have to have one obvious one. So I'm going to go with the Lord of the Rings series. I mean, I know that's also a very dangerous place, but I could see myself hiding out in the Shire.
Yeah, I mean, the Shire would be amazing.
Or Rivendell or something. There's so many nice places.
There's so many nice places. It's really about the real estate, to be honest.
Yeah.
You should just move to New Zealand, really. You could have that for real.
Yes, seriously.
I mean, at this point, though, you know, like those movies have become so popular. Like, how expensive must Rivendell be? Like, God.
Well, they don't let you in. You're not an elf, Lee. You can't live there. They've got rules.
Well, neither is Jeremy.
Well, yeah.
He's also not a hobbit or a he's not any.
I could fake.
He's not even a man.
Hobbit. Oh my God, I don't fit in anywhere.
Okay, Lee, what's your number three?
It's Gollum. All right, my number three. I'm still recovering from Jeremy stealing my brilliant Who Framed Roger Rabbit pick, but I'm gonna go with Men in Black, another organization I think I'd fit in nicely
at. That's a great pick.
I hate what happened with that series, although the second and third movies, I don't even know if I ever saw the third one especially, but they're so bad that I feel like they're just forgotten, and Men in Black still kind of stands as a pretty creative and good sci-fi movie from the 90s. And I just think that, you know, working again, I don't need like the big job. I can just work, you know, in the office with the, you know, friendly aliens.
So I think you want to be on The Office.
Yeah, that's my number one.
I mean,
one.
It's a pretty interesting office. There's all these aliens.
Yeah, aliens and it's great. I think it's great.
Okay, is it my turn?
All right.
So, I would never want to go to prison, but if I had to, I'd love to be in Shawshank.
Oh yeah, that's a good.
Friendship is a.
You know, everyone would bet on you the first night.
They probably would, but I think if I went in with a beard and my long hair, I would look tough. I can look tough. I'm not tough, but I can look tough, I think.
I can't do either.
So, yeah, and I feel like, you know, you would make the best friends of your life in there. I mean, like, he doesn't end up with a girl.
Oh, yeah, in the
he ends up with Morgan Freeman. Yeah. They presumably spend the rest of their lives together.
On a beach.
Yeah. I just think it's, you know, I don't know, of all the prisons, like, it's not, like, a glamorous prison. Like,
I think
not,
it is. I mean, I did notice an interesting thing. Like, I watched this in, like, Escape from Alcatraz. And everybody seems to be roaming around freely in these prisons, and it's actually quite grand. With all the brick, you don't think so, Lee?
Yeah, I don't know. I guess if you got an outdoor detail in May.
I like how Chavin just likes the architecture.
Well, that's what he got his top five bars with, those Boston bars with all their wood. He likes Boston bars with wood and prisons with brick.
Yeah.
I'm up.
I'm up with my number three, which has already been mentioned. It's Rick's in Casablanca. I mean, if we're gonna go with a specific spot, it would be Rick's for me. Like you said, it's just the allure of that place is off the charts. I still wait for a bar to recreate it so I could go in there and experience it even for 10 minutes of my life.
See anybody. Does anybody ever pay their tab at Rick's? I never see any money being exchanged, except for maybe a passport or two.
No, the only time you see money exchanged is when he's like, "I'm shocked that there's gambling going on in here," and then the guy comes over and gives him
his
winnings.
Right.
All right, it was kind of going back and forth on my number two here. I'm gonna go with The Truman Show. It's probably pretty egotistical, but I think it'd be cool to have the, you know, world be a movie about me.
I don't know that I'd watch that.
I think that'd be pretty interesting to watch. I mean, what? Like, I'm literally right now, like, why would you not watch this? There's not a light on in the house. There's the computer screen, a microphone, and I'm talking to myself.
Yeah. Yeah.
Roll cameras.
How do you know that you're not a Truman Show, though? That's the whole thing about Truman Show.
Oh, my God. You just gave it all away. I did just get a Google Home Mini, which is sort of like today's equivalent of that. You know, Google just kind of...
What is that?
It's like an Amazon Echo. I got it for free with a Nest thermostat. I don't know if I'll use it or not. I don't, but that's sort of the same thing. Or it's the closest thing we have to it now.
I'd be careful with that.
All right. Is it me?
Yeah.
Yep. Two. You're on two, right, Kevin?
This also came up on a list. Again, forgive me. But my set number two is the underwater oil drilling station in the Abyss. I don't know why I'm attracted to that station, but I think it would be a lot of fun to be down there. In reality, you would have a very high-pitched voice because you would be breathing helium or helox, but I think...
That's just reality.
I think the way it's represented in the Abyss would be fun. You're just kind of, you know, underwater.
I have to watch that movie. I hate to say it, but I have to see that movie.
It's really good. Yeah, it's really good.
All right, my number two, and this is also a movie that's come up on a couple of my lists, but it's The Adventures of Robin Hood, the Errol Flynn version. It is a movie that, I mean, everyone's so calm and cool and collected, and everyone's so good with a bow or an axe.
So are you Robin Hood in this scenario?
I mean, ideally I'm Robin Hood in this scenario, but even if I'm not, as long as I'm not one of the guys that gets, you know, an arrow in the heart.
Right.
One of the bad guys, as long as I'm one of his merry men, I'd be fine with that.
Yeah, that's a good one. You know, a lot of those fairy tales, not the right word for Robin Hood, but like, you know, that kind of genre, I think would be cool to kind of hang around in. All right, my number one, like my number five, is a series of movies. But it's, again, me kind of wanting to just be a part of this group. And what's nice about it is, like, I'd be okay with just being, like, myself, a human being in it, or I'd be happy to be one of the Muppets.
You want to be a Muppet?
I want to be a Muppet. Look, they get to go on so many adventures, like, and, you know, they all, they're, you know, they always come back to each other. They're good friends. Like, it seems like a good, you know, community or cult, whatever you define them as. And look, like, they've been, you know,
you get to travel through time.
Yeah, you travel through time. Like, they've been on, like, pirate ships, and, you know, they have Christmases together. I don't know. I just think it's really nice.
They seem to have memory loss.
Well, look, I mean, they have...
They don't remember their past.
Yeah, I mean, it's true. I mean, that's nobody's fine, nobody's perfect, and I feel like,
exactly,
you know, that's what makes us great here at the Muppets. I'm actually there now. I've ensconced myself.
My number one is, I have always wanted to... I'm obsessed with space travel and the space race and that kind of stuff in general. But I'm also very claustrophobic. So, like, I don't think I could be on the International Space Station. And in a lot of cases, space goes wrong, and I'm terrified of the void of space. But if I had to, I think it wouldn't be that bad to be on the Jupiter mission in 2001.
It doesn't completely go
no
well.
It doesn't. I didn't say that it went well, but again, I think it would be an interesting, you know, they seem to be having a good time. They got a lot of space. They're running around that wheel. They don't have to do anything. They're eating, they're getting, they're like pressing buttons and then food comes out. They're watching iPads.
All right, that being said, my number one is a time and place and moment that I wish I could just visit, if not live there forever. It's Almost Famous.
Oh,
interesting.
Yeah, it's sort of a sweet one, to be honest, but it would be a place and a time that I would just enjoy thoroughly, even though I think there would be plenty of drama and plenty of heartbreak, but, you know, you guys seen the movie.
Well, thank you for listening to this edition of the Get Your Film Fix podcast, and we apologize to have to do this again, but we're going to plug ourselves. If you could,
oh, feels so good.
Like us, share us again, just, you know, chat to a friend, give them a recommendation. We would love, and we'd love to hear some feedback. Feedback at getyourfilmfixpodcast.com. You know, we'll read it on a podcast, won't we, guys?
Yeah, absolutely.
Especially if it's bad, then I mean,
yeah, cut to you pieces of
yeah. If it's insulting one of us, we'll definitely read it out loud.
I'm staying. I'm finishing my coffee. Enjoying my coffee.